You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll take a look at, first, Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves delivered her Mays lecture last week. What did it actually tell us about a future Labour government? Second, and finally, we'll turn to another listener question. How do we stop wealth leaving the country when we try to tax it? On to my first story this week, Rachel Reeves' Mays lecture. So last week, Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves delivered her Mays lecture, which by tradition is an opportunity for whoever is Shadow Chancellor to lay out their approach to economics in government. This got a fair amount of attention, perhaps surprisingly so in some ways, for what was quite a dense, even academic talk. Most of that attention was centred on the sections of the speech released to the media beforehand, with Labour comms spinning this as Reeves wanting to emulate Thatcher. There was predictable consternation across the left about this, which presumably Labour's spinners bargained for wanting to happen. From their point of view, it does them no harm if their big story is still "We are not Jeremy Corbyn" in big capital letters, to then have a load of Corbynistas complaining about them. Equally, it's good, from their point of view, to have a bunch of Telegraph readers getting the message that Reeves really, really likes Margaret Thatcher. So it's a win-win. But it's not good enough for those of us trying to understand what's happening in the world to take the spin at face value. Reeves' speech was actually very substantially a criticism not only of Margaret Thatcher's economics, focusing on her Chancellor, Nigel Lawson, but also, implicitly at least, a criticism of New Labour for sticking too closely to Thatcherite economic policy and so to neoliberalism. This is all consistent with what Reeves has argued since becoming Shadow Chancellor, or even before, around building a critique of what she has elsewhere called hyper-globalisation. So on the positive side, Reeves has a clear recognition of the major weaknesses of British capitalism, as capitalism itself might recognise them, centred on low productivity, which is the product of low investment and therefore results in low growth. Reeves also recognises the key features of, in her words, the new age of insecurity, geopolitical instability, technological change, climate crises. Globalisation, she says, is dead. And anyone who has followed her work in the last decade or so will recognise the focus on the everyday economy, her phrase, and the need for concrete improvements in its day-to-day functioning. But I think we need to be very clear that whilst much of the critique we might agree with, Reeves' proposed alternative is a very long way from the one I suspect many Macrodose listeners would be putting forward. It's been my argument here, and elsewhere, that the era of neoliberalism is drawing to a close. Over the last 40 years or so, how governments did economic policy was dominated basically by the ideas that markets should lead the economy and governments should get out of the way of corporations and the wealthy. This is what we've all lived under in Britain, in successive governments from the late 1970s, but it really became a global condition from the 1990s and into the 2000s. Under pressure of competition from China, in particular, which only ever partially adopted some neoliberal ideas at most, governments across the world now are moving to subsidise their industries, impose tariffs on imports, and even, as we've seen with the US under Trump and Biden, pretty aggressively trying to block rivals from accessing the latest technology. Along with this, the worsening chaos of a climate-shocked world, from extreme weather to pressure on natural resources, is forcing governments to intervene more and more in the economy to protect some pretty basic systems, like, for instance, the growing use of government insurance for households in places where private insurers are now refusing to provide it because of climate change, places like Florida or California. Put this together, and what you're starting to get is a big shift out of a way of running capitalism in which free markets and big corporations and the wealthy have as free a hand as possible in shaping the world, to one in which governments are now more involved. What Reeves is arguing for is very much part of this shift. She and Labour have insisted that they are copying what Joe Biden is doing in America, for example. But an exit from neoliberalism does not necessarily imply some return to what historically has been called social democracy, In other words, increased government spending on public services and an increased share for workers in national income. This is what we tend to associate not only with Labour governments in Britain, but with similar governments across Europe over the last 70 years or so. One way to think about this is to put it in quite Marxist terms as having governments that were concerned with social reproduction, healthcare, education, unemployment insurance, things like this. In other words, those elements of the capitalist production process concerned with the reproduction of labour power. In other words, the capacity of people to work productively in particular. When it came to production, what people were actually doing in factories, for example, post-war social democracy, governments like Labour's, were largely hands-off, especially so in Britain. Ironically, New Labouring government was the most dramatic example of this separation between production and social reproduction. New Labour delivered lots of funding for the NHS and education, but had an almost pure, neoliberal, hands-off approach to production, so there was no industrial policy, for example. Now, by contrast, there was strikingly little on traditional social democratic social reproduction concerns in Reeves' speech, which focused almost entirely on production and how government would help organise this. She even called her approach productivist at one point. The nearest parallel I can think of in recent British history is the rescue of the British car industry after the 2008 crisis, which involved industrial strategy and government intervention overseen by Peter Mandelson for a key sector supporting demand and rebuilding supply chains, whilst also continuing with the broad outlines of neoliberal policy elsewhere. Mandelson himself, writing in the Sunday Times over the weekend, identified these elements as central to what Reeves and Labour are offering. It's pretty clear that he personally thinks this is a reprise of his time as business secretary at the end of the 2000s. In terms of the Labour Party, the tradition that all this is closest to is not New Labour. It's more like the so-called old right. This is the almost forgotten section of the Labour Party tradition that was closely associated with the right wing of the trade union movement and very concerned with the specific interests of historically a narrow band of relatively skilled workers. So, for example, they'd support rights for trade unions, something Reeves has stressed, and industrial policy and government investment. But there was no real concern here with social reproduction spending, unlike New Labour and, much more comprehensively, Jeremy Corbyn. It's something that's not really been near the leadership of the Labour Party for a very long time, or at least not especially influential on policy in this way, perhaps not since about 1979. So if Reeves and Starmer's Labour is a break with neoliberalism, it's also not looking like even the kind of social democracy that New Labour represented. The key issue to grasp here is that their pivot on the economy is happening at precisely the point where the economic crisis is increasingly manifesting itself as a crisis of, you guessed it, social reproduction. That's what the end of cheap labour means on a global scale, both a limit to easily available, untapped labour reserves, there's no second China, and the rising cost to capital of an ageing and increasingly sickly population. Climate and nature crises manifest themselves as further costs and barriers. The generous interpretation of Reeves' response to a world of rising costs of social reproduction is that she's insisting that growing productive capacities can overcome them. A less generous reading is that what she's setting up is a logic of exclusion, managing rising costs by breaking fundamentally with universalism, even beyond New Labour, and setting hard boundaries about who will and will not be included in the state's vision of a better future. You can see this clearly, for instance, in the clamour on getting the sick back to work, which has been a talking point of Labour's front bench in the last few weeks. So neoliberalism is being drawn to a close, here in the UK and across the globe, but that doesn't mean we're entering a better world. The fight now is over what comes next. Rachel Reeves has given one answer, whose logic has little to do with traditional social democracy. The progressive fight is to see this for what it is, and then work out how and where we can push back. Our second story this week is a listener's question from John, who writes, "Hi James, hugely enjoying your podcast and learning a great deal. Such a relief to listen to economics without mysticism. Your comments on Novara Live about the weakness of sanctions against Russia reminded me of this argument. One, capital is free to move and does so electronically at the speed of light. Two, UK government is constrained by terrors, real or imagined, of capital flight. Three, UK government therefore kowtows to the super rich and the finance sector by imagining spending limits as per Osborne, Hunt and Reeves. Therefore, we need to impose slash restore capital controls to create space for public spending and also restore some democratic influence over fiscal policy. Is this argument sound? Would it be necessary, practical or even possible to impose capital controls? Thanks for this question, John. There's a fair bit to unpack here, so it's likely to be worth me coming back to it at some point in the future. First, the great claim under neoliberalism was always that governments had no choice to do what finance capital wanted, because if they broke with neoliberal prescriptions, then capital flight would surely follow. There is no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher famously put it. In other words, hypermobile finance capital would, at the flick of a trader's computer key, disappear from the economy and be sent elsewhere in the world if a government misbehaved. So governments had no choice but to do what financial markets said. Bill Clinton's chief strategist, James Carville, put it like this back in the 1990s, I quote, "I used to think that if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as the president or the pope or as a .400 baseball hitter. But now I would want to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody," unquote. Clinton himself was told, so the story goes, on entering office that whatever else he might want to do on increasing social spending, he had to cut the government deficit first, or else capital flight would ensue. Now, there is a danger of something like this happening to smaller and typically poorer economies. It's happening right now to some of them, as interest rates grind upwards in the US and the developed world, making poorer countries less attractive to investors and so leading to mobile financial capital pulling away from them. But for larger economies, with their own currencies, particularly like the US, there was an element of mythology about this. In practice, the super rich, for example, will have a great deal of wealth in assets that you can't actually physically move, like mansions in Kensington or wherever. In reality, successive US governments have run monumental deficits, ironically usually bigger under Republican presidents, to fund monumental defence spending, and there has been no capital flight to speak of. Often the opposite, borrowers are rushing to lend the US government money. Where I think the real threat today comes from is not so much the financial markets themselves, as the interaction between the major central banks and those financial markets. We had a dramatic recent example of this in Britain. Now, everyone knows the story about Liz Truss's government, that she tried to borrow too much money and the financial markets punished her by driving up interest rates, ultimately leading to her resigning in disgrace. Except this isn't really what happened. First, if interest rates for government borrowing shot up under Truss, they are today at about the same level under sensible Rishi Sunak. So it's not the case that her government was uniquely bad or ridiculous. There are other factors pushing up government borrowing costs, mostly to do with Britain's perennial, long-term economic problems. Second, it wasn't the markets that ditched Truss. It was the Bank of England. There was certainly something of a panic about Kwesi Kwarteng's September 2022 fiscal event, so-called, with its billions of extra borrowing. But the Bank of England stepped in rapidly to calm markets and promised support to pension funds affected by this. But that support was time-limited. It was only due to last 3 weeks. As the deadline approached, on the Friday of that week, the governor of the Bank of England, speaking at the IMF in Washington on Tuesday that week, announced that the bank would not be continuing its support. This is a pretty incredible thing for a Bank of England or any central bank governor to be doing. Your primary thing as a central bank is to be preserving financial stability. And yet here was Andrew Bailey, governor of the Bank of England, announcing loudly from the biggest platform he could find that the Bank of England would be withdrawing its support and so provoking financial instability. The result was an immediate and worse market panic, which in turn forced Kwasi Kwarteng from office by about the weekend, the reversal of his economic programme and Liz Truss's resignation soon afterwards. It was the Bank of England that pulled the plug on her government, not the markets. You can see something similar happening internationally. Big central banks now regularly provide support to their political allies in the form of what are called swap lines, which are really cheap lines of credit for dollars or euros or yen or whatever. So in an emergency, like 2008 financial crisis or COVID, The Federal Reserve, for instance, can guarantee cheap dollars to the Bank of England or the European Central Bank, and those central banks in turn can guarantee support in dollars to their own financial institutions, who may have lots of dollar liabilities that they can't pay for. But if this support can be offered by a central bank, it can also be withdrawn. So China, which had been financing Argentina's government via a swap line, announced it was cutting its support to that government after the election of the anti-China fanatic Javier Milei. In other words, the real problem for us to concern ourselves with now is perhaps not so much financial markets as the power and influence of central banks over those markets and the fact we have, for decades, deliberately made these institutions independent of democratically elected governments. It's dangerous for democracy, and actually for broader economic outcomes, to have such increasingly powerful institutions operating without proper oversight and control from elected governments. So thanks for that question, John, and we appreciate your support. As always, keep those questions coming in, and you know where, on our email and over at the Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.